Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Believe Knicks podcast. I am Matthew Miranda, joined by Stacey Patton. Even half a world of distance cannot keep apart, particularly when there is a lot to talk about in the world of the Knicks, and it has been a very exciting time in the world of the Knicks. There's pretty much no end to the things that we could talk about. So let's get the obligatories out of the way. BetOnline remains your number one source for all your sports betting this season. Everything from pro and college basketball to UFC, MMA, and more. You'll always find the latest odds, team matchup info, player news, and game trends at BetOnline. With live betting options, free contests, and live scores for almost any sport or game imaginable. BetOnline is truly the fastest and easiest way to bet all your favorite leagues and events. Head to the website today or use your mobile device to join and receive your 50% welcome bonus with your first deposit. Make sure to use the promo code BELIEVE, B-L-E-A-V, to receive your rewards. BetOnline.ag, where the game starts. Stacey Patton, where the pod starts is laid at your feet. There is no end to what there is to talk about with this team right now. What's the first thing that pops into your mind or into your spirit when you think about where we are?
I mean, pretty much everything. There's so many storylines that it's almost tough to... it almost feels like every single player on the Knicks, I could say, man, we really should be talking more about this guy, right? Here's an example that no one is really talking about that much. Like, if you bring him up, people will be like, oh yeah, he's been playing well. The Knicks had a rotation player whose minutes they were losing quite a bit. He was a free agent acquisition on a team that has had some up and down luck with those. And, you know, the guy in front of him went down and, you know, his weakness was defensive rebounding on this team. And he turned into one of the best defensive rebounders in the league. He held the fort down until Mitch came back. And Isaiah Hartenstein has really improved and has given the Knicks the best backup big they've had, really, in the Thibodeau era. I mean, Nerlens Noel was pretty good in 2020, but, you know, I would have to say Hartenstein right now is playing better than that. More well-rounded, to say the least. And that's just, like, there's so many guys, right? We probably haven't talked enough about how rare it is to just, you know, you think about a lot of these trades, these midseason trade deadline trades. For playoff teams, it can be tough to incorporate new guys. How often do you guys see a guy fit in as seamlessly as Josh Hart? We probably still aren't talking enough about the fact that Jalen Brunson is on a steal of a deal, although more, I mean, he's playing like a max player. He's playing like an all-NBA player, making $20 million a year. You know, if I wanted to be really reckless, I would say this is probably the best value contract. I can't remember a max player who wasn't on a rookie deal playing this well since a certain Golden State Warrior had questionable ankles his first few years and ended up signing for $11 or $12 million, which opened the way for, which helped them, you know, build around him, right? Probably aren't talking enough about how much Randall has grown. So, like, every player has contributed. I would even say, I mean, RJ Barrett is catching a lot of flack, but I think a big part of that is, like, the other guys who play the same position are that good. I don't think RJ's been that bad. I think he still gives them a skill set that's useful. Like, I don't know if we've, in my time as a Knicks fan, honestly, since the 99 run, I would have to say, I can't remember the Vibes being this good. I don't think they were ever this good in the D'Antoni era. I don't think even in 2012, 2013, like, there's no weakness on the roster right now. Does that mean I think they're going to go all the way? I'm starting to entertain that it's possible, which is maybe the craziest thing of all. Sorry, I just talked for a lot, Matt. But the long and short of it is, like, the fact is that I could literally mention every rotation player on the Knicks and talk about how their contributions are still not getting talked about enough, because there's only so much you can talk about, and you have to talk about everyone, you know? So
it strikes me hearing what you just said at the end there, especially I think the Vibes a couple of years ago were also when this team got on a roll late in the season, behind Randall. I think the Vibes are better now, because I think I was thinking about this the other day, like a couple of years ago, late in that season, the Knicks, the Hawks, and the Heat were all kind of swirling around that 4, 5, 6 spot. Yeah. And I remember being very concerned about getting Miami. Like, yep. I felt very nervous that the Knicks had had this really nice season and they were going to get like the worst team they could get in the first round, and it was going to like kill the Vibes. And as it turned out, Atlanta did that. But 2 years ago, I'm terrified of Miami. And this year, like, really over 7 games, span of 7 games, it's remarkable to me how far everything has come. And it's not just 7 games. Like, this team has been playing at a high level really since December. And
you know what gave me confidence really in that? Yeah. Because I was talking with Schwinn about this, and you know, Schwinn has been more critical of a lot of the decisions in the play, but he's been higher, I think, on the overall ceiling going back to the summer. So right after Mitch got hurt, the Knicks were facing about a 15 or 17 game stretch where I was like, man, even 4 or 5 wins will be tough here. And Mitch is out. And they finished that stretch with, I think, 8 or 9 or 10 wins. And they didn't win a ton of games, but they played better than they had been playing despite Mitchell Robinson being out. A huge part of that was that Isaiah Hartenstein, the light bulb clicked at coincidentally the right time. Maybe it was the fact that he had to be less worried about getting pulled or whatever. I don't know. But that before, like, they got, and then they got Harden, they just started blowing teams out of the water. But that's when they were able to manage without Mitch, I was like, all right, hold on. You know, like, they're hanging in there in what should have been probably the death knell for their season. I'll let you finish, but to your point, like, this precipitated, I think, the way they responded to Mitch Robinson getting hurt, which was as well as you could have hoped.
And there had been a little anxiety there, because the first 2 games after Mitch went down, it was Atlanta and somebody, they lost, and they gave up like 130 a night, and it was exactly what you were afraid of. I think there's been a lot to be said for Hartenstein is probably healthier right now than he's been all season. Yeah. Because you just see he just cracks me up that even in the net game, when literally it's like everything on earth is clicking, like, Hartenstein just, there's a little funny magic to him where just things will go wrong around him, like at a certain gravity. I don't know what it is. Like, he gets the ball underneath sometimes, and there's 0% chance the ball is going to, like, something, someone's going to slip, like he's going to accidentally. But to his credit,
that Marcus Smart block was insane. That was also just Marcus Smart being ridiculous, but
yeah. Yes. But that
things
doesn't
like happen. That, right? Yeah.
It just comedically, that would only happen to Hartenstein. But he has been, wonderful in a variety of ways. I have been struck by, I thought of this a lot when I was after the Nets game, when I was writing the recap for it and thinking about between the two teams, like, differences. And it's funny to me that the Knicks, even more than 2 years ago, to your point about maybe the Vibes haven't been this good since 99, even compared to the team like 2 years ago, there's a sense of excitement about not just what they're doing, but like the composition and the ceiling and the sustainability of it.
Well, I think it's also, I think
even if you drank the Kool-Aid during that 2020 run, right? There was always a sense that, okay, this is Julius Randle playing way above his head. So you're speaking this your sustainability, but like it was basically Julius Randle, Reggie Bullock having a career, but you know, could hit some threes. It was really a Julius Randle a bust. Derrick Rose putting some punch off the bench, but it was just it felt more like this is a team that tries really hard. It's during a season where a lot of teams are missing important players, and this team is playing hard. And I don't want to diminish what that team did, but I think there's a reason why the takeaway from that was Tibbs, whatever your faults are of his X's and O's, he's going to get a team to compete every night, and that can raise their ceiling more than you'd expect. This team, I'll give Tibbs credit. He's made some good adjustments, particularly shortening the rotation, which has made a ton of difference. This team has legit firepower, right? Like they have tons of guys who could go off for 30 in a night. Like, Josh Hart is the proverbial glue guy. But the guy, like, gets to the rim at will. He can hit threes. He can hit tough shots. And he comes off the bench quickly. I mean, I think a fun exercise would be how many teams would quickly start for. I think it's 25, legitimately, because he can start at either position. And then you have, like, your third option is RJ Barrett, who scores 20 points a game. And as rough as it's been at times, it's a career high in efficiency. Yes, low bar, but still. If that's your third guy, you have two guys playing at an all-NBA level. You have an all-NBA level defensive center. All defense level center. I believe so. We can discuss that if you don't think so. I think the best bench backcourt in the league. A sniper. Like the Bullock role is played by a better version of that in Grimes. This feels like a team that legitimately has a ton of guns. Whereas that, like, if you're talking about an army, this feels more like it feels like a powerful army. Maybe not the world's greatest, but a very powerful army that's gonna knock you the fuck out. Whereas last year's team, or the 2020 team, felt like a guerrilla unit that just is no fun to play. That's a phrase a lot of people have used about the Knicks, and even this season, right? They're no fun to play. They're a pain in the ass. They really grind you, and that's true still. But they also have legitimate firepower, and they are really tough to stop and talented in a way that they haven't been. Even 2012 obviously had Melo and Chandler and Smith. Oh, I think that's another great follow-up question. I want to let you talk on this, but which team had the better center, I think, is a good question. Which team would win is another good question. But the point of the matter is, like, even that team was relying on guys like Jason Kidd, even Prigioni, who I loved, was 33. Like Steve Novak. Like, you're relying on these guys who, like, fit well around Melo. Like, the talent on this team is, overall talent is high. And you can say Melo is better than Randle. But there's no one like Brunson. Like what? We had two legitimate stars. You know, that's been the goal for, like, that's what we have right now. In both cases, it feels very sustainable, including Julius. Julius Randle's still only shooting 34% from three. Like, he's shooting better from mid-range, but he's taking way less. Like, the whole thing has been, his process has completely changed. So why would I not think it? Like, why would I think it's going to be 2020 again? But the big difference to me is, like, that felt like a team that tried really hard every night and got the most out of it in a unique season, to say the least. And this team just feels really good, period.
So I wrote the other day about how when I think of the Knicks and the Nets comparatively, especially specifically the KD Kyrie Nets.
Was this your very polite monologue on the Nets?
The title was like in French. I don't even think I knew what it meant, but it was a very. I was assured it was a very sophisticated French. It was of some sort. So
sometimes a team in Brooklyn deserves the Bronx cheer. So,
I'll tell you actually that was the original title, and then I had switched it to something else.
Oh wow. That was the exact title, Bronx Cheer for the Brooklyn.
Nice. Yeah, well, that's what we'll call it euphemistically.
I do want to highlight a line. Eat a dick, Nets Twitter, Nets Income, Nets Daily, Benjamin Nathan Yahoo, NetZero, Netscape Navigator. Why is Netscape Navigator catching strays? Come on. Craig Nettles, and anything remotely net related.
So I got a little bit of feedback, a little bit of, what's the term? Blowback from fans of Benjamin Netanyahu, apparently.
And why do you? I see it.
I will just reaffirm, as I said on Twitter, that to make sure that I'm completely clear about this.
I wanted to call out Josiah, but I thought I'd call out someone worse. You know, that would be the response.
Fuck Benjamin Netanyahu. That's why he's in the joke. But there was a part in the piece where I talked about how.
Sorry, I got to read. And then one of the replies was, my brain misread that as Matis Yahoo. I was like, I don't know if I love his music, but he seems like an okay guy to me.
That was very funny. That cracked me up. So I mentioned, when you think about the approach that the Nets took to becoming the KD Nets, it was very much the behavior that someone outside of New York City would view as a caricature of how a New York City team works. Like, the Nets completely, they had a little thing going, and they blew it to smithereens the instant there was the opportunity to bring in this brand name, sleek, like, high-rise franchise. Like, immediately tore down the old neighborhood, threw it up, sold out everything to it. Everything about it was excess and just big city gravity. And the Knicks, meanwhile, and I don't even think it's all but intentional, but I think, you know, all teams that have had success building a winner have had luck go into it. So I don't know how much of this has been the Knicks' conscious intent. But the Knicks have built this really nice thing that they have going now and forward-looking around really efficient use of late first round picks, really efficient use of the free agent market, and signing players to deals that turn out to be, like, they've signed now two different players who have played at all-star, if not all NBA level, to deals that are very quickly like, oh, that's a good deal. And that's a good market deal.
I mean,
it's not the New York Knicks.
Sorry, the last month and a half, like, this calendar year, Jalen Brunson has been playing at an all-NBA level. He's been playing at an MVP level. That's what he's been doing. But,
like, if you take away the New York Knicks and you have that description of a franchise, but it was the San Antonio Spurs, or it was the Utah Jazz, or it was some smaller team that we're used to thinking of that way, it would make sense. You'd be like, oh, what a, you know... Yeah, that's how successful franchises do it. The Knicks have done it that way. And I have found it very striking as the two teams have flipped kind of places right now.
And also building through the draft, right? What if you added these descriptors, right? Found a potential, I mean, he's not going to make first team all defense, but an elite defensive center in the second round. Yeah, that was before this front office. But, you know, they've managed his development. They found a potential sixth man of the year at age 23 at pick 25. They found a starting shooting guard shooting upper 30s and playing high level defense at pick 25. You know, they, for a protected first and a bench player, they got, you know, they, I mean, the Josh Hart move is the kind of move that, you know, if Danny Ainge made it, people would be sucking his dick all day. You know, people were like, first, I don't know. Well, first of all, what's crazy is the Knicks, everyone was like, maybe we should have given up the Dallas first. Like, the Knicks giving up their own first, lottery protected, I don't know. The Knicks, at this point, it looks like they gave away the worst of the two firsts, you know? Because right now it looks like our picks, quote unquote, our pick is going to be in the 20s, and the Mavs are around 17 to 20. And we might even have two picks because of the Wizards pick. So, you know, there's a whole lot of thought. And I think to your point, some of the stuff they did probably look out on. We know that, you know, Quickly was on the trade block, and, you know, who knows if they sold low on him, you know, maybe that looks different, right? There were other draft decisions, but the flip side of it is, you know, there's been other things where they've been unlucky. So, overall, the way this front office's process seems to work, in the long run, they're going to be right more often than not, and that's pretty good.
Let me ask you this question. I haven't heard anyone bring this up yet, and I feel okay about it, but I'm just, it's weird to me. What is different about Jalen Brunson's season this year than Julius Randle's season 2 years ago, as far as Randle 2 years ago performed at this unprecedented level and a year later crashed and showed he couldn't play that way and sustain it? Jalen Brunson is having this career season, doing things at an unprecedented level. We're all very happy with it. Is there any reason to think this is more sustainable than, or does this, or do we review now, do we reassess how we view Randle and maybe last season? I'm still torn with Randle. Like, is last season an anomaly? Because Randle is very, has been for a while. He alternates years, great year, down year, great year, down year. And, you know, depending how far you zoom in or zoom out, that could be coincidental. Like, there were other, he was on bad teams before. That might affect things. A lot of things last year with the Knicks went wrong, like, not just him. I don't know how to read that pattern, but I don't feel concerned about Brunson. Maybe because some of the numbers have shown that some of what he's doing just seems like the progression of a player who's arrived rather than, where did this random three-point shooting come from? But you're not nervous about Brunson, I'm assuming.
Yeah, so that's a great question. We can definitely talk about Randle as well. The long and short of it, I don't think this is remotely similar. Oh, sorry. It is him overperforming, but there's a few things, right? I think it's easier to trust when a player has shown you these things and he's just getting a chance to do it more. Like, there's nothing Brunson's doing this season beyond maybe taking more pull-up threes that was unprecedented. He was a career 38% three-point shooter before coming to the Knicks. You know, if you break down his shooting, right, you know, he was always – he's actually shooting – last year he was shooting 70% at the rim. He's a 69% nice finisher at the rim for his career. This year he's actually down to 60% at the rim. Taking 15%, which is not great. He's shooting only 49% from 3 to 10 feet, which is excellent, by the way. I'm not only is relative, but you know, last year is at 52. You know, he's shooting 41% from three, which is higher, and I expect that to come down a little bit. But you know, like, it's not like, and his shot profile hasn't really changed much. Still, he's taking more pull up threes. You know, this year, like, the big difference is for his career, he's only 26% of his threes were pull-ups. This year, almost half of them are. But I think that's also a Knicks thing. Like, they encourage, they seek that out in a skill set. And Prez put this a good way. You've seen them do this with Josh Hart a little bit, where they are good at finding inefficiencies in players' shot profiles. So if they believe that a guy like Brunson can really change the game with his pull-up shooting, they're going to look for guys like that. With Brunson and Hart, it's really worked. So I think in terms of a shot profile, stylistically, he's doing the same thing he was doing very effectively his entire career. His efficiency, like, hasn't even really gone up. It's on just much higher usage, which that in itself is an accomplishment. Like, you can't take that for granted ever. But, you know, it seems more believable than a guy who just started shooting way better than he ever had in his entire career. On a very difficult shot profile, right? So that's number one. So going back to Randle, it's tough. I think LA, there was a lot of turnover. They went from tanking teams to going for LeBron teams. You know, he's playing different roles, playing the four, playing the five. And then he went to New Orleans, you know, playing the four, playing the five, but he wanted to be the guy. He was the guy his first year in New York. It didn't work out. Second year, he shot well. Third year, didn't work out. So what I'm about to say is, I generally hate when most commentators and analysts do this. I tried to avoid talking about Julius Randle in these terms last year. I'm not a psychologist. None of us are psychologists. We don't know the man. We don't know what he's like in the locker room or personality-wise. We see snippets on camera where he looks angry or whatever. So I'm going to preface this by saying all of that. But it seems difficult to believe that his emotional state was not a somewhat of a factor last year, especially relative this year. There's just a lot more positive energy, right? Or maybe we're not seeing the negative energy from him. It seems Brunson's a little less susceptible to that. And then the last thing is, I think they help each other, right? So Randall, I think, has benefited this year from not having to go it alone. And Brunson also doesn't have to go it alone. And his weaknesses, you know, are covered up a little, or not weaknesses, but the guys on this team complement him well and allow him to do what he does best. But I do think that's a fascinating question. And my answer is, I think that the front office, I think the fact that he did this in the playoffs without Luka, the fact that his shot profile is basically the same, the fact that his skill level has obviously always been very high, and all the shooting indicators were there that he could do it on higher volume, I would be very surprised. I mean, do I think maybe he finishes the year at like 38, 39% from three, maybe ups his volume eventually to like Harden levels and gets to like 37% from three or 36% from three. But I don't think you're going to see something like a Julius Randle type 2021 regression.
I don't have that sense either. I think a lot of it, like you said, is what he did in the playoffs, I think, showed something. Like, I think Randall, like a lot of people, hit the playoffs for the first time and faced a level of intensity that he had never seen before, and he struggled with it. Do you think – I'm really curious about how Randall's performance, or if Randall's performance so far this season, like how much it has impacted people's like perception of what he can be. Do you think do you think Julius Randle can be the second best player on a championship team?
Did you say best player or second best player?
Second best.
I think it's tough to believe that he can't right now. I would say yes. I think it would have to be the right player. I think it would have to be someone who can, you need him next to a creator. So him playing next, like he's still like, even, I mean, he gets a lot of buckets that are self-created, but they come off of some kind of ancillary movement, right? You know, yes, of late he's been like doing more of those walking into pull-up threes, but his decision-making is usually quick and off the catch. It might be a drive. It might also involve a counter and a behind the back, but it's very rarely like he's doing a lot less Carmelo Anthony, right? All the Carmelo Anthony buckets are coming from Jalen Brunson. Randall is acting a lot more like an Anthony Davis, I guess, or a player in that mold who they're self-created, but they're off of motion. They're, you know, they're giving him simpler reads. They're asking him to make quick decisions instead of, you know, doing sophisticated multi-combo moves to get a, like, get to a spot, beat him there, and then if somebody's late catching up to you, in trying to catch up, they lose leverage and you're too strong for them. If somebody tries to body you, you're too quick for someone who's putting all of their energy into trying to keep you out. Like, in that, like, keep things simple. That's all you have to do. And if there's too many bodies, then pass it. So you would need, I think he can be the second best player on the championship team. I think you need to protect him with a rim protector. You need to assume that he can continue to hit open threes. But I think the fit with Mitch has been good this year, so I think that's fine. But you need him next to a creator. And usually that creator would probably be your best player on the team. And what's interesting about the Knicks is the follow-up is, can Jalen Brunson be the best player on a championship team, assuming Randall's your second? And that's where it's like, on the one hand, like since January, he's been playing like one of the top five best players in the NBA. On the other hand, you know, besides Steph, there hasn't really been a player in the modern era who's sub-6'5 or sub-6'4 who is the best player on a championship team. But together, maybe they could do it, especially if they're playing next to an elite defensive center, especially if they have a high-level shooting guard who can hit a ton of threes, especially if they have a wing. I mean, the upside in this team, I think, involves RJ Barrett, things clicking, right? Maybe he does go on a run the way he did his sophomore year, starts hitting a lot of threes, plays tough defense, and like, I think he's starting to figure out a little bit. So to answer your question, I think Randall can be the second best player on a championship team. I think Brunson can as well. And I think you might see one of those guys be the best player on a championship team. You know, like they're not that far off, and this is kind of wide open. Would I expect them to win it? No. And we can talk about that in a second. And then the last thing I'll mention with Randall is the reason, besides the fact that he's much more efficient this year, the reason why I'd be more willing to say yes than I would have been even during his hot 2020 season is his defense. I think it's tough to win when you have a guy at the four who struggles, but he's legitimately a plus. He can switch a little bit on defense. He generally makes the right rotations. You're very rarely seeing the ones. There were so many times where like he would collapse into the paint, and then if they kick it out, you see him like walk or lumber, or not even sometimes. You just watch the guy take a three. Those are the things that really had people out on him. You rarely see that anymore. I'm sure Brunson taking some of the load off on offense helps, but you know, he's giving you the requisite defense. He's giving you a good shot profile. He can make tough shots. He keeps the ball moving. He's not some, you know, counting stats guy who hurts the team. Why not? You know, like if you put Randall on the Warriors, he would be their second best player, right? A Steph Randall team, I think, could contend. It's debatable. So let's leave Boston out of it. If you put him in Denver, he'd be the second best player. That might not be the cleanest fit because their offensive games are, you know, they take up the same kind of space. But
you put him ahead of Jamal Murray.
So and the West is just a shit show. So the West is a bad example. And then it's tough because a lot of the other teams I don't love the fit. Actually, that would be interesting. Like, if you played Giannis at the five or you played Randall at the five, like, that front court could be pretty devastating. I think you'd probably prefer it to be a high-usage guard in, like, the Steph mold or the Dame mold, but I think it could work. Or like, a wing like if Dallas ever did bring Randall home, I think he'd be really fun with Luka. But thankfully, that's not the case. They got someone else from New York. By the way, since that trade, the Mavericks are 1-4, and the Knicks are reaping the benefits as their draft pick is improving.
Yeah, there's much to talk about as far as that whole move goes, and I keep struggling a bit with Dallas because you need them to lose, but you need them to lose like a certain amount. Like,
yeah,
they're
not going to lose that much to like actually.
I don't think so. Just they have the energy to me now of a team that
could just collapse.
Yeah, and then they win the lottery. Like, just here's Dallas question for
and
you.
And then if they get Luka and Wemby, that would fucking,
that's what I'm saying. Yeah, exactly. And suddenly Mark Cuban is a genius again, even though he's not. Would you, as a Knicks fan, trade Randall and Brunson for Luka?
Sorry, you cut out a little bit. Can you? It's my end. The connection's not great. Can you repeat that?
Would you trade Randall and Brunson for Luka?
Wow. And I don't have to give up any picks?
Not really. Not a devastating amount of picks. No.
Like maybe one a pick? First. Maybe a first. Yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, that says more about Luka than Randall and Brunson, but
it does.
He's what, 23?
He's so good.
You're getting potentially a guy who looks like he could finish his career top 10 player all time.
You're getting Larry Bird.
Yeah,
you're getting Larry Bird at 23.
That's racist, Matt. But you know, say Magic Johnson with a jumper. Magic Johnson had the mini game. Yeah, I probably would do that. Which puts things in perspective, right? That the Knicks don't have that guy. And I think that's what's fascinating about this team, because they're playing about as well as you can be playing without that guy.
Yeah. And I feel when I watch them, not to harp on the good things, this isn't a complaint, but just watching, you know, if you just swapped out RJ for like a Luka or even a Paul George, like just slipped RJ out and slipped a guy like that in, the ceiling is enormous all of a sudden.
Paul George, I mean, it's interesting what's happening in LA. Kawhi seems like, even if the team implodes, like he wanted to move to SoCal for a long time. He's from there. Paul George is also an LA guy, but he can be a little bit mercurial. It's very interesting. There's a lot of guys who you take a look and you're like, here's another situation, right? Write down I-95. James Harden has the ability to opt out and be a free agent this summer. And they are one implosion away from that happening. And I'm not saying the Knicks should trade for James Harden. But I will say this. I love Mitchell Robinson. You know, if Joel Embiid is available, Mitch, I hope you like cheesesteaks. You know, that's all I got to say. Even with the health issue, if Joel Embiid turned into Amari Stoudemire, I would live with that, to be honest. It's worth it. He's too fucking good. He's a generational player. And those are the kinds of guys you're talking about. You know, the same thing with Luka, right? But there are going to be some guys, and you add them to this core. And the other thing I do want to mention, though, is kind of for all the talk, you know, everyone mentioned a lot, Leon Rose is a CAA guy. He wasn't brought here to do Moneyball shit. He was brought here to sign high-level stars. Mm-hmm. The Knicks have taken very much that kind of an approach, though, because Jonathan Macri mentioned in his newsletter today, they're actually a bottom 10 team in shooting this year. They're not a good shooting team, but they're top 10 in offense, or they're an elite offensive team. Why? One, they have good isolation scorers, but two, Randall has talked about this, right? Tibbs talked about this, how with Randall, they tried to change his shot profile to more threes and more rim attempts. And the way Tibbs said it, actually, you have to love it. He said, it's not no mid-range, but it's being selective about mid-range, right? And if you look at the moves that they've made, it really looks more like how do we create a contending roster by taking advantage of these inefficiencies, right? By taking advantage of the fact that, you know, we have maybe the – we can just pound the offensive glass to make up for the fact that we may not have great spacing. We can, you know, have guards that can get to the rim. All of our guards are. I think another thing is
don't turn the ball over while they're getting to the rim.
Yeah, right. So you win the possession battle. This is a common thread with that 2012 team. Actually, don't turn the ball over at all. And we add to that the offensive rebounding. Their guards all Grimes doesn't, but Brunson and Quickly are very notable for their efficiency from 3 to 10 feet. That's been the biggest leap in Quickly's game. He took a lot of. He's taking the same amount of shots from 3 to 10 feet he took as a rookie. Last year, he took fewer and his efficiency went up. This year, he's taking the same amount. As a rookie, he was 39% from 3 to 10 feet. This year, it's over 20% of his shots. He's making 52% of them. I wonder how much it helps that the king of that range is is the guy he probably goes up against in practice every day. But a lot has been written about how the floater is kind of an efficiency, right? Where you know, if you're good at that shot, that's a tough shot to defend. So they have two guys. So they've exploited these kind of. It used to be, I think, the first level of analytics, and now this is getting into a little bit of a tangent. But the first level of analytics was like, what are some of the first level things? Like, what kind of shots should you be taking? What kind of what kind of skills should you value? Right? What those kind of things? What kind of shots should you be taking? What kind of counting stats provide the most value towards actually winning? Now it's like, you know, what are the things where if you're really good at that, it impacts more than you think? And I think the Knicks have done that. I think offensive rebounding, particularly from guards, that's where they found that there's what that should cost. There's a market inefficiency with that. Guards who can hit floaters and defend. There's an efficiency of that. I haven't talked about Quickly yet, which is probably a record during a stretch where he's playing well for me to go 37 minutes without talking about Emmanuel Quickly. But so to kind of on that note, 538 had an article last week about Derek White. So Derek White on Raptor, and Raptor is a metric that I have some issues with for like the advanced all-in-one stats beyond BPM and Darko plus minus. I don't really use anything. Raptor, I think, especially on defense, I have some issues with their methodology. But Derek White in that and a lot of other stats shows up as a top 10 player. Derek White is known as a good player, top 40 probably, maybe top 30 to like if you're a hardcore guy. He's no all-star. He's not viewed that way. But I think the point of that article was like a lot of the things that he's good at get captured there. And there's a lot of guys in that mold. They also, in another article, they have written about they wrote a lot of the same stuff about Quickly. And Quickly fits that mold. A guy like Kyle Lowry fit that mold. Fred VanVleet. So what do all of these guys have in common? There's a few things. Number one, they can play on and off ball. Number two, they can all defend. And number three, they can hit pull-up threes, and they can hit floaters. And guys like that, you know, positionally versatile plus defensive guards who can take shots that accentuate the offense and create easy opportunities, because that floater also creates so many easier opportunities for others, right? Because it forces the defense to defend more space. They can't pack in around the rim, or they have to send more guys to the nail, which opens up threes. So you're either making lobs easier or you're making kickouts easier. You're playing on and off ball. So like there isn't like you can fit in with a variety of lineups. You can defend again, can fit in with a variety of lineups. And if you can hit the pull-up three, which is kind of the most dangerous shot in basketball, or not the dangerous shot, but like when a team is hitting that, it stresses you more than anything else. Relative to the fact you look at a guy like Emmanuel Quickley or you look like Derek White and you're like, yeah, these guys aren't Ja Morant. These aren't jump out of the gym athletes or like 40-point-per-game scorers. But it's just skills that make the whole team better. And that's just one archetype. But I think the Josh Hart archetype, you know, a 6'5 guy averaging 8 rebounds a game, you can shoot, defend multiple positions, average 4 assists per game without needing the ball in his hand a ton. They've gone for guys like that. Obi, in some ways, with the passing, gives you that. So I think they've found these guys whose, like, some of their skill set is not as, the totality of their skill set and its impact is greater than the sum. They've found a lot of guys like that, as opposed to just the, what was thought was going to happen was you sign the biggest name, right? So, and I think that applies to the Brunson signing, right? Yeah, Brunson was a young guy with scoring ability, but, you know, it was kind of, he had these skills that don't get priced the way they should on the market, and now they're reaping the benefits.
Is it time to officially declare Hart sanity? There are a lot of connections between Josh Hart's debut and Jeremy Lin's, and it's not just he's playing well. If you remember the insanity wasn't just a matter of a player coming in and playing well. It was not even just a matter of a player coming in and excelling at a specific role that team was specifically lacking in. That was a rough year for Knick point guards. They were trying Baron Davis. They were trying Mike Bibby. They had tried Iman Shumpert right out of college. They were giving him
Tony
time.
Douglas.
Tony Douglas. Like, that was not a great point guard laden team. So and Lin hit that spot perfectly. And it wasn't even just that. It was also there was an energy around this person in terms of how he played. There was an obvious drive for winning that this player had that was affecting people around him. And Josh Hart has that. Like, you watch this guy play for 7 games, and it's unmistakable. Like, at first you laugh, you're like, oh my God, like his first couple of games, there were things that would happen. And I was like, I'm laughing because I'm like, boy, like, you know, as if the narrative isn't there enough, like that breaks his way or he happens to. And then you keep watching him every day and it happens every game. Like, it's what he does. Obviously, there will be nights that he will have just off nights, as all players do. But you can see that when this player is clicking, this is what he does. And it's remarkable to me. Other than Jeremy Lin, I can't think of a player who just hit this way like a bomb just right away. It's really remarkable. He's a fan favorite in 7 games.
He, you know, I think I tweeted this before. He, if you told me this guy played for the 90s Knicks and he was in the middle of a series and he just got time travel dropped off here, I would believe that. That's what it really feels like. Like, he just feels like that era level of player. I know, I think with the Jeremy Lin comp, sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah.
So I think with the Jeremy Lin comp, I think I'd be more surprised. So Josh Hart is doing some things that he wasn't doing. He's talked a little bit about how his role has changed here versus Portland. You know, in Portland, he wasn't taking as many threes. He made it clear that as soon as he got here, Tibbs gave him the green light. You know,
I'm sorry. Is there an implication there that, because his 3-point attempts plummeted this season from what he did when Portland first acquired him and Dame was gone, and I think I don't know if Simons was injured. Is the implication that Portland told Hart, "Cut, we don't want you taking, you don't have the green light there"? Because he,
I think the way he described it, another thing, reason why everyone likes him is Josh Hart is very diplomatic. So he went out of his way to say this is not a critique of the Portland Trail Blazers organization. He said it was this actually after I forget which player, but there was a player who got hurt. You know, there was some controversy. He went out of his way to defend the Portland organization, whether you agree with those specifics or not. This is a guy who's very, you know, who takes a very diplomatic high road type of stance. What he said was his role was not to be a 3-point gunner, right? It was more as a slasher. It was more, you know, at Portland before he got traded, he was taking 46% of his shots at the rim. So, you know, next to Dame, next to these guys, you know, he was kind of a slasher. And here what they've asked him to do is space the floor for, you know, the Knicks downhill guards. And that's what he's done. And he's another guy who likes the 3 to 10 foot range. You know, he's an elite finisher at the rim. So he's also doing things at a higher level. To answer your question, I think it's less likely than Sanity because a lot of stuff we've seen him do at a high level before. He's averaged 8 rebounds per game for 4 seasons now. He's actually averaging less now. He's only averaging 5 rebounds per game. Part of that is a minutes decrease. But what's crazy is also that he's averaging 12 points per game in 7 less minutes than he was in Portland, where he's averaging 9.5 points per game. So his scoring's gone up. You know, those minutes have gone down. By the way, it's really good that he's just bought into coming off the bench when he started for. Yeah, he's been a starter since, the last few years, right? I mean, there's a lot of guys who wouldn't take that in stride. He clearly doesn't care about that. Now, he's shooting 60% from three. That's obviously not going to last. Sorry, Knicks fans. He's shooting 78% at the rim. That's probably going to come down closer to 70 and, like, on the lower side of that, which is still excellent. He is an excellent finisher who gets the rim a lot, but he's not going to be, you know, he's not going to be Zion Williamson at the rim the way he's been for the first 7 games. It's just the parallel to Insanity is you just dropped him in and like magic. Yeah. There was no adjustment period. There was no clunky rotations fit. Like Tibbs knew exactly what to do with him right away. And it's just been, it's the last time actually I will say, I don't think Linsanity is the last time I remember it. Actually, the last time I remember someone just seamlessly fitting in like that, or it was the last time the Knicks made a midseason trade or a significant one. And that was Derrick Rose in 2020. So that's another question, right? Was this, you know, that 2020 season, the Knicks seemed like a team that was going to be in the play-in. You know, they seemed like they were no longer an embarrassment. They were a competitive team, some nice young players, but not a serious, you know, certainly not a team that would finish, that would probably even clinch an outright playoff spot, let alone finish with the 4th seed. And Derrick Rose put them over the top. Do you think Josh Hart is this year's Derrick Rose acquisition?
It's a little different for me because they were playing well before they got Josh Hart, like in a big picture sense, like for the whole season. They were, whereas when they got Derrick Rose in the 2020-21 season, they got Rose right around the time that Mitchell Robinson went out injured, and there was a lot of concern that, like, oh my god, that's going to tank their year, and like that kind of coincided directly with Rose getting there and just being brilliant. I feel like Rose was more of a direct, like, a moment where things turned. With Hart, I think they were leveling up, and then he's just injected them with, like, you know, an infusion of leveling up on, you know, the 10th multiplier. It's remarkable. I didn't mention his name because, you know, you don't want to be sacrilegious, but in the annals of Knick history, as far as people arriving and having instant perfect harmony and impact, of course, Dave DeBuscher is the patron saint of those people.
Dave DeBuscher is a great comp, right? Also, like, tough as nails. I mean, Hart doesn't play the four, but he plays like a 4-2, right?
He does. Yeah, he does.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, he would also fit in well with those 70s Knicks, right? Especially with the ball movement and all that. So,
I will.
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. I will say that I would know that if you dropped Josh Hart, like I would know he was not a 90s Nick only because he shoots so much better than pretty much all the 90s.
He would never have a Starks game, right? By the way, I think a Starks game is coming. So there's going to be some rough shooting performances. He's not a 60% three-point shooter. But he could – I mean, he was 37% his last year in Portland. So, but he's probably closer to 36, 37, maybe 35, even with the green light and the confidence and the good looks he's getting, more than like what he's been. So, but
he seems very happy where he is.
It's worth noting too. Like he does have great chemistry with the guys. Like he's become close with Quickly very quickly. He's obviously like got the bromance that set the internet on fire with Brunson. And there are worse things than getting a really good player who also happens to be your best player's best friend on the team, right? So. Maybe they'll get us Michael Bridges too, and we need Michael Bridges to come across two bridges and make it happen.
And we might need the Nets to bring the asking price down a bit from what they were getting. Yeah, I mean, this season.
Isn't it like they've never traded with the Knicks in like the last 40 years or something?
It's some very odd long stretch. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Who would you want to? They have some interesting players. Who would be? Would you want Bridges the most off of that roster?
Who would I want what? Sorry.
Is Mikal Bridges the net you would want the most off of that roster?
I think so. I mean,
yeah.
Simmons, I do think a Brent Simmons reclamation project on the right team could work well. I seem to remember another 6'10 player who couldn't shoot but could pass really well and handle the ball like a guard. He did pretty well in San Antonio. So I'm not saying Ben Simmons is Boris Diaw, but if there's a coach, but I don't know if Top Pops has the patience for that. I think that, yeah, like if I had my choice, it's easily Mikal Bridges. I like, there was the whole Nick Claxton, Mitchell Robinson controversy. It's actually an interesting debate. Like I can see why people would take Claxton. I think Ben Ritholtz, friend of the Claxton's good, Ben, but they're different players, to be honest. Ritholtz, friend of the pod, had a really good tweet. Like Claxton is more versatile on both ends, but you know Mitch is a better option against burlier guys, right? He has more weight on him, and he's probably the best rebounder in the league. Claxton himself is a really good rebounder. I think my new thing that I look at a lot in centers is if you're good at defensive rebounding and you rack up a lot of blocks, that probably means you're really good. Because I think that there's generally a negative, like slight negative correlation, because the more blocks you chase, the, you know, your defensive rebound is going to suffer, right? Just because you're not in position. So a guy who does both, like that Claxton deserves props. I think it probably comes down to team fit, but they are really close. So Nets, there were a lot of Nets fans who were like, that's insane, blah, blah, blah. I was like, hold the L. And I do think that in a head-to-head matchup, Mitch is going to win that more often than not. Unless Claxton develops like a better jump shot or something. But Claxton is up there in terms of talent, but Mikal Bridges is like one, like the perfect fit. Like if you're like either, even whether he plays next, whether he takes RJ's spot or Quentin Grimes' spot, the one thing this team is missing is like a truly defensively versatile three. Like Hart is giving them a little bit of that because of his strength. Like someone with the length of Mikal Bridges who can also hit a bunch of open threes, create his own shot in a pinch. Yeah, that would be, I think it's pretty clearly him. And then, but in terms of more realistic options, there is a CAA client who CAA likes a lot, who plays there by the name of Cam Johnson, whose name has been on the trade block a lot. I don't know when he becomes a free agent, but I think you could probably play him. It becomes tricky because he's a four, but he might be the kind of guy you could play him as a three and you can give him minutes as Randall's backup four, since it's not going to be a lot of minutes a game anyway. So, you know, he is apparently a restricted free agent this summer with a qualifying offer of $8 million. It'll be interesting to see what the Nets do with him. My guess would be they'll make him the qualifying offer, probably match up to 20. So it's probably not an option, but Cam Johnson would be the other guy I would mention as a more realistic option. But if I had to pick one, it's pretty clearly Mikal Bridges, and I don't think it's close.
When you talk about Claxton and versus Mitch, I get a little bit of a Mobley, Jared Allen thing, where I think Mobley's more talented overall than Jared Allen is, but I think there are certain fundamental things that Jared Allen's just bigger and better at than Mobley.
I think Jared Allen versus Mitch is a good conversation too, because Mitch had a little bit of a regression and everyone's like, what did we ever think Jared Allen and Mitch were on the same level? And now it's like Mitch has been better this year, flat out.
One of the great, like, underrated, like, foundational pieces of this season's success is that Mitchell Robinson got the big contract that he was waiting for and has been better since he got it.
Which is the last thing everyone expected. Like, yep, most of the talk was about, you know, there's, I don't want to say, I don't think people went so far as to call them character concerns. The word somebody closer to the situation told me, and not to say I have sources, but somebody who does, said the word described was goofy.
Yeah. Which, when you have like five agents in 4 years, it will raise eyebrows.
Yeah. Because I specifically asked, well, is his work ethic in question? And everyone, like, who's everyone, I think, whether I've asked them or just talk about it, no one, I think, has ever questioned his work ethic. I think they question kind of the direction. And, you know, some of it is unfair, right? Like, if the guy is posting himself shooting threes, that doesn't mean he didn't just spend 3 hours working on his post moves, right? That doesn't mean he didn't spend, you know, a bunch of, like, right. He's reshaped his body. Like, he's put on, like, remember who he was as a rookie? He was getting shoved under the hoop on defensive rebounding opportunities. I had no idea to box out. Now he's, again, maybe the best rebounder in the league. But I think that, you know, the idea that he would just not only take this contract and maintain his production, but actually raise it to another level, I do think that caught a lot of people off surprise. And you're hearing a lot less people say, oh, man, we should have taken Jalen Duren, blah, blah, blah. Nah, man, we got one. And unless we're getting Embiid or maybe DeAndre Ayton, that's our guy for that's the guy I'm going to ride with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They had a rough stretch earlier this season, and I remember saying at the time, like, they could trade Mitch, because I thought it was the easiest path to an instant upgrade, and that, like, Jericho Sims could roughly approximate, between Sims and Hartenstein, you could roughly approximate a lot of what Mitch does, but Mitch this season has elevated him. Like, Jericho Sims is not on Mitchell Robinson's radar as far as impact. It's not an indictment, obviously, of Jericho Sims. Just saying, like, Mitch is that guy.
Yeah, I mean, Jericho Sims is a young player. I think it's clear, like, when he was given, you know, he started over Hartenstein, he wasn't quite ready for primetime minutes every night. I think he's developed well. He's certainly given them value beyond the 50th pick already. But he has, I mean, even when he learns the game better, and when I say that, I mean to an NBA vet level, right? I'm not saying the guy, like, for a 24-year-old, 23-year-old, it's fine. It's just to get to that level, he needs to get better. But he also has certain physical shortcomings. He's 6'10", listed, probably closer to 6'9". He just has freakish hops and long arms, but Mitch has advantages he'll never have. And the thing with Mitch is, like, you do need, like, that kind of a rim protector if your best two players are going to be Jalen Brunson. If two of your starters are Jalen Brunson and Julius Randle, so a four who's not really a rim protector and a one who has, you know, massive defensive shortcomings, you do need a guy like Mitch. And you need good perimeter defenders around them. And the Knicks have made that work. So me, like, going back to the question you asked before, like, those answers are a little bit conditional on the team you surround them with, which, in fairness, I think when you say a guy can be the second best player on a championship team, by implication, I think you're saying that there's, you know, a customized roster you would need. But, it's clear how important Mitch is to this team. And, you know, him and Emmanuel Quickley have been trading basically the on-off title back and forth all year. You know, I think the Knicks are about 8 points better when with each of them. And another hallmark of Tibbs is he's actually staggered them a lot. It was like someone posted the Knicks' top lineups, and either Mitch or Emmanuel Quickley is in all of them, like the top two-man lineups. But if you look, like, Mitchell Robinson and Emmanuel Quickley aren't up there because they just haven't played enough minutes together, which is, I think that'll change in the playoffs, but I think Tibbs intentionally staggers them because you have one, I think it's fair to call Emmanuel Quickley an elite defensive player at this point, given his impact. You have one elite defensive player, and also not just the elite defensive player, but those are the, like when those guys are in the game, they're the ones quarterbacking the defense. They're the ones who talk the most. They're the ones making the calls. They're the ones who often make a read that's a step or two ahead of the defense. So he, one of them is always out there. And but Mitch's impact has just been phenomenal. And I think it makes that, it takes that Brunson and Randall duo to another level because it allows them to do things. It allows them to play to their strengths and mitigates maybe some of the things they're not great at. Or mitigates, I would say, more things that they don't give you. Like, I don't think Randall's a bad rim protector. It's just, you need someone to provide it in your lineup if he's going to be your four, because he's probably not going to do that much of it.
Speaking of four, the Knicks later tonight, in their sudden pursuit of the four seed, will be playing the Miami Heat, who are a little bit less of a concern than they were seven games ago. So keep an eye out for that game. We're good for this episode now. Stacey Patton, very good to be back in contact and touch with you, and look forward to talking to you again very soon about hopefully a 8 or 9 or 10 game winning streak. Everybody, thank you for joining us, and we will be back in a few days. Take care.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile Coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.